Welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast, where you'll hear from inspirational female leaders who are real models as well as role models. Our guests on this show have one thing in common. They are passionate about supporting all women to achieve success. Here's your host, Amanda Alexander, multi-award-winning coach and founder of the Academy for Talented Women.
Hi, this is Amanda Alexander. You're very welcome to another episode of the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast. In this episode, I interviewed Ness Knight, who is an adventurer, an explorer, and a record breaker. Her journey as an explorer started out when she decided to take a sabbatical from her job. She went over to the US and she became the first woman to stand up paddleboard 1,000 miles across the Missouri River in the US. That was when Ness got a taste for adventure. She cycled solo and unsupported 2,000 miles across the US. Since then, she's been the first woman in history to swim the length of the Thames River. She has run 15 marathons, that's 400 miles, back to back from London to Land's End. And she has done a solo fat bike expedition across the Namib Desert. Next year is her ultimate record-breaking attempt. She is preparing to be the first female to row the Pacific Ocean solo and non-stop. Ness believes that when we challenge ourselves and step outside our comfort zone that we grow, and this is really the focus in our interview. You will find Ness inspirational because she's so real. She reveals things in this interview that she's never revealed before in public. We talk about self-belief, we talk about depression, and we talk about the nature of courage and what drives us. Whether you want to cycle across the Namib Desert, or whether you just want to step up in your career or do something different in your life, I know you're going to be inspired by Ness Knight. Hello, Ness.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, and I am so excited about interviewing you today. Thank you very, very much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ness, I'm going to start at the beginning. How on earth do you get started as an explorer? It's not something you can go and look up with a job advert in the paper, wanted explorer, is it?
No, actually, that's one of my jokes is, you know, on all these online forms, there's no drop down for explorer. So officially, my job title is other. It's quite an unusual one, I guess. But yeah, I guess best job description as well is that I basically specialize in hauling everything I need to survive around with me around the most remote parts of the world, which is a bit of an unusual one. So fair question, how do you get started in that? In my case, it was definitely by accident. I kind of stumbled into this career, and that happened probably about 5 years ago now, 5.5 years ago. I used to actually work in digital in London, and I just had a bog standard 9-to-5 as a marketing manager, and I was actually working at the time for a company called School for Startups. It was actually a social enterprise, so quite a few people might have heard of them, and it was phenomenal. We basically taught entrepreneurship, and I was responsible for the digital arm of that. And I just realized after quite a few years of doing this that I spent all of my time teaching other people how to go about living their dreams and making their passion into a business. And I really wasn't taking my own advice. And so I decided, I didn't know at the time what I really wanted to do. I knew lots of things in my life that I was passionate about, but I didn't know what direction I wanted to go in. So I just took a year off and I quit my job and I headed out to America and stand up paddle boarded 1,000 miles down a river because no woman had ever done that. And actually no person had gone that far. So why not, basically? Got to the end of that and swapped my stand up paddle board for a bicycle and just felt that the journey wasn't finished. I hadn't figured out what direction I wanted to go in yet. And so I was going to carry on thinking about this on the road until I figured it out. And because of my background in digital marketing, I knew how to tell a story. And I was really passionate about storytelling. And so along the way, along my journey, cycling west across America along Route 66, I just shared my story online through a blog and through my social media. And before I knew it, I suddenly had this following. And it was completely unexpected. I mean, I thought, well, it's great if one or two people stumble across it. But all of a sudden, I had this audience. And as I carried on pedaling across, and I was thinking, okay, well, what can I do about this? Because I really have fallen in love with adventure and wilderness. And this is really, truly where my heart is. How can I use this audience and this newfound kind of niche to make a business? Because it was a niche. There were very, very few people making a business out of this and a career out of this, and let alone women. There are lots of women doing this sort of thing, but they weren't in the limelight, and I just couldn't figure out why they weren't getting that limelight and able to monetize on it and make a proper business out of it. And so I thought, right, well, I've got the experience in teaching entrepreneurship. I've found the thing that I'm passionate about. So I'm just going to take another step into the unknown and turn this into a career. And so, yeah, it was a little accidentally, but yeah, I guess when you open yourself up to opportunities and spontaneity, you tend to stumble across some very interesting things, which is what I did.
So you said that you took a year off and then you paddled 1,000 miles down the river, as you do during a year off. Like, okay, I'm just going to paddle 1,000 miles down this river here. How did you take the year off and then paddle down the river?
Yeah, I guess it's quite a bizarre one to do, but the kind of seed for that idea, I suppose, was when I was working my 9-to-5 in an office that was pretty much a windowless office in central London. I'd gone on one of my lunch breaks, and I'd bought this into one of those shops that sell postcards. And I bought a postcard that said, "What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?" And I just thought, oh, that's really sweet. I really like that. And bought it. Didn't really think very much of it. Pinned it on the bottom of my computer because it sounded like a really nice quote that was really inspirational. And 3 months later, I kind of sat back one morning. I thought, oh, I really don't want to be here. This is, you know, sat behind the computer, two massive computer screens in front of me, you know, growing my hunchback. And I thought, this is not right. I'm just not feeling this at all. And I just, for the first time, I looked at that postcard and really read it. And I thought, okay, well, right now, in this moment, what would I do if I knew I could not fail? Because that's been a big theme throughout my life, is that fear of failure. And I just thought, you know what, I would go out into the wilderness and I'd get space and, you know, time to breathe and to do something that's physical, because I loved the gym. I loved working out. Something that's mental, so that psychological challenge of going on an expedition and into the unknown when you've never done anything like that in your life before, and that huge challenge. And I guess that's where it came from. And so, yeah, I just ended up paddling down the river, and it was just, yeah, quite a bizarre start, I suppose.
That's really interesting that you say that fear of failure had always been a thing for you throughout your life. Tell us more.
Oh, well, here's a story I haven't told anyone yet, actually. So I guess it started really when I was quite young. I suppose going really back to the very start, when I was about 6 or 7, I was growing up in South Africa, and it was quite an outdoors country, and I spent half my time building tree houses and sitting in the mud, and my mom screaming at me to get inside and try and get me in the bath, which was forever a chore and probably still is to this day. But I really believed as a 6 or 7 year old kid that anything was possible. You know, I had a vivid imagination, and I used to spend my time in my mind imagining these amazing worlds and universes that I was traveling through, and, you know, heroes are born out of adversity, and it was just this incredible magical world, and I believed that anything was possible. And then I went to school, and that's when things started to change for me, because all of a sudden I was introduced to schooling where, you know, you were taught to fear failure, because you better not get lower than a C. And if you get a D, or let alone an F and a complete fail, then God, there's something wrong with you, you know. And that's where that kind of started. And the story that I've never told anyone is that I guess I stumbled in my early years in primary school because I was labeled. And the reason I was labeled is that we were put through at a very early age, and I don't think this is right, a IQ test. So the whole school at primary school was put through this IQ test. And a handful of us were sent off, shipped off to a place called Johannesburg School for the Gifted. And they said to us, well, you're too smart and you need extracurricular activities after school. And so at first everyone, you know, my parents thought that was wonderful and my friends were like, wow, this is new and unusual and interesting. And then the teachers kind of started treating me differently because I was now the special kid that had been labeled as smart. And really and truly, I really disliked going to that school for the gifted, and it just wasn't my scene. I didn't enjoy any of it, and it became a very not pleasant place for me, but more so because when I came back to school, the kids saw the teachers treating me differently, and I got labeled and kind of outcast from that. And I was this kid that was special, so no one wanted anything to do with me because the teachers liked me. And then I rebelled because I didn't want to be excluded. And I think a huge part of us as humans is feeling connected to people around us. And I did not feel connected at all anymore. And so I rebelled and my marks plummeted. And then the teachers and my parents and everyone around me thought, God, what is going on with this child? And I guess, you know, I was told I was smart and I had even failed at that. So my confidence was utterly shattered. And I was quite a shy, introvert kid. And so I really, really, truly stumbled my way through school and didn't do very well. And I don't think that anyone really, truly, apart from my parents, expected me to come to anything much. So for me to be doing what I'm doing today is quite a long journey to get to where I am. But yeah, definitely that fear of failure in school was kind of instilled there. And I just think it's such a shame because as real young toddlers, we're encouraged to fall and get back up, you know? And at what point do we change that conversation and that dialogue and start instilling that fear of failure? Because in my mind, personally, I see it, you know, any mistakes that you make and any failures, I now, having gone through the journey I've gone through and adventure and exploration has taught me this, you know, I see those failures as life's tuition. They're part of the most important part of our journey and the thing that makes us grow and become stronger, you know. And I think without them, it's very difficult to be successful. You have to be prepared to fail. That's part of the journey. So, yeah, that was quite a long-winded explanation of why I think, you know, that fear of failure had been a big theme in my life and it was a big thing for me to overcome.
Gosh, thank you very much for sharing that with us. So when you saw this postcard, and you kind of thought, okay, what would I attempt to do if I knew that I could not fail? And yet you'd had this whole kind of hangover from childhood and from having your confidence knocked of fear of failure. How did you bridge that gap between that innate fear that you'd kind of, I suppose, nurtured inside you and doing something so huge? I mean, most people, if they feared failure, would be making baby steps.
I guess that kind of theme of jumping headfirst into my fears started a few years earlier than that. Because I'd gone through those difficulties in childhood and I knew the person inside me wasn't this nervous, scared, shy person. And I was uncomfortable in my own skin because I didn't have the skills and abilities to communicate and talk properly with people and really just be who I was and have, be confident in that. So when I moved from South Africa to the UK at the age of 15, it was actually an amazing thing because I said to myself during that move and when I landed this side of the water, this is a clean slate. This is an opportunity for me to change how things were in South Africa and start a new chapter in my book. And I promised myself that if I do one thing over the next 10 years, I would slowly but surely take on my biggest fears. And the very first one of those was when I was, oh gosh, I think it was about 20. And I really felt like I hadn't made too many inroads to doing that. And I decided, well, I've got the summer ahead of me. What's the thing I'm most scared of that I can just say, you know what, bugger this. I'm going to go out and do that. Because I've had enough. I've had enough of being introvert. I've had enough of, you know, lacking the confidence. And I've got all these great, amazing ideas of what I want to do with my life. And I will be so disappointed if 20 years down the line, I haven't done something to change that and chase them. And so I really was terrified of sales and negotiation and strangers, walking up and talking and making conversation with strangers. So I looked online, and one of the jobs that really spoke to me to overcome all of those was being a face-to-face fundraiser. So, you know, there's people on the streets that you banana walk around who ask you to sign up to charities, and that encompassed everything that was terrifying to me, sales, negotiation, and strangers. So I did that, and really, it was my first day was awful and horrendous, and I stood on the street. I didn't speak to a single person. I was just smack in the middle of the street, shaking all day long. And I just thought, no, come on, you've got more inside of you. I'd kind of hit my rock bottom that day of disappointment in myself. And so the next day I went out, and I just went for it all out. I suppose because sometimes when you hit that rock bottom, there's nowhere else to go. So you're like, okay, bugger it, I'm just going to go for this. And yeah, it worked out for me. And I realized that it's never as scary in real life as it is in your mind, ever, ever. And I, within a few months, I was team leading, and then I was coaching and managing the national campaigns for multiple charities and their face-to-face fundraising. And yeah, it became one of, well, at one point, the most successful female fundraiser in the country. And that happened quite quickly, and I really surprised myself. So really, it was just that courage to take those first few steps, to go completely blindly into the thing that you're most scared of and surprise yourself. And the more I did that, the more I realized that it's not as scary as I think. And actually, every single time, I'll surprise myself in a good way more and more and more. And I just built up confidence that way. So by the time I got to that little postcard and thinking of, you know, what would I attempt to do if I knew I could not fail, it was a little bit of a habit. But I, as we all do at some point in our life, I just got stuck in a rut and I got complacent and I stopped chasing my dreams. And that's where, after a few years, I realized that I was just doing life and ticking off other people's boxes of, you know, get a house, a car, a dog, a cat, you know, and good relationship. But really, there was nothing personal and passionate that I was chasing within that. And that's the point where I kind of sat back and went, ah, right, okay, what would I do if I knew I could not fail? And I wrote a list, actually. And it wasn't so much of a bucket list, more of a kind of booting myself up the ass of, you know, the things that I wanted in life. Like, I didn't want to get old and regret the things that I didn't have the courage to try. And those things were on my list. And so, yeah, that's the way that came from.
And on those things on your booting yourself up the ass, were some of those doing the 400-mile run, marathons back to back?
No, they were very vague, actually. So I have always been really interested and passionate, probably because I was quite introvert, about the mind and the body, about psychology and that relationship also between mind and body and challenging ourselves. And I knew for a fact through experience that we can always go further than we think we can physically. Yeah. It's just our mind that kicks into that survival mode that says, no, conserve the energy. And so, yeah, we can always get through a little bit more pain and go a little bit faster and further. And so I wanted to explore that. And I also, growing up in South Africa, I really loved wilderness and nature and animals and the outdoors. And so that's, I suppose, you know, it was only inevitable that I would go out and spend, you know, my first year of doing what I want to do, doing something in, you know, the realms of adventure and exploration and challenging myself. But yeah, definitely it was more of an accidental stumbling into this career, in terms of really having a list of things like these expeditions that I do now.
I'm going to ask you a question now, and it might put you on the spot, and you'll have to provide what I think is your natural modesty. What makes you okay? So you've said that you've had these fears, and that you've said you've had to be courageous, and you've got that curiosity. But what do you think it is? The quality or the combination of qualities that you have that has actually made you do something about this and create this incredible career and become this record-breaking adventurer, whereas 99.999999% of people who even thought they might want to do that would never do it?
Interesting question, and a really hard one to answer.
Sorry.
It's easy to observe outwards, but sometimes, yeah, the real difficult stuff to observe inwards is quite tough. It's not one thing. I was certainly not a born explorer or a born entrepreneur. I learned everything along the way. And if I really think about it, probably the one quality that's got me to where I am right now would hands down have to be just resilience. Because if you can keep getting back up after people say no or things go wrong again and again and again, you're absolutely going to find your way to success. You know, that's really what it's down to. Because I've been told no, and I've been, you know, people have closed doors on me more times than I care to count in my life. And I just keep getting up and chasing that and saying, no, that's not good enough. And it was the same thing, you know, with confidence and courage is baby steps, really and truly. Just it's our courage is, you know, and our mindset is a muscle. And unless you're working it and doing something about slowly building that up, then it just becomes stagnant and weak. And, you know, you have less to call on. So if you can just bit by bit by bit work on that courage and confidence and just hold on to that little bit of resilience. And I suppose perhaps the other thing is visualization. You know, I don't know where I got that from. I guess as a kid, I always had this vivid imagination and it's never gone away. And I have this ability, I suppose, to really in absolute thorough detail and depth visualize where it is I want to get to. Even if it's not a super defined kind of pathway, I know that direction I want to go into. And so I start imagining all the different ways that I could open doors for myself or try things. And if that went wrong, then how would I react to that and pick myself back up? And so before, I wouldn't just leave things to chance in terms of how I feel and how my internal narrative goes. I would proactively beforehand visualize, okay, so if somebody said no to me, and then the next person, the next person, the next person, and I got 30 people down the line saying no to me, how would I be feeling and how could I get back up and what could I do about that? And so I'd be prepared for that already. And I guess that's helped me a lot, both in life as well as in expeditions, is knowing. And you know who talks about this very well? If anyone has heard of Brené Brown, I'm not sure if you have, I'm sure you have.
Yeah.
She is phenomenal. If you look up her TED Talks, she's incredible. And she talks a lot about courage. And the one thing that she says, which I really, truly live by and believe in, and it's what's got me to where I am now, is this idea that you have to have the courage to step into the arena. And you will get bloodied and you will get battered and bruised in that arena. But that's where the success lies for you. If you're a spectator on the side, that's all you're ever going to be. You have to get into the arena. And if you're there, you know, you've got to be ready to fight your way and battle your way to where you want to get to. And so it's that expectation that it's not going to be a breeze ahead of you, but also that positivity that no matter what, you'll get through it, I suppose. So, yeah, resilience and courage and bit by bit growing confidence like a muscle.
Fantastic. Oh, yes, you are speaking my language. And actually, that just alluded to something that comes from a quote. I think it's Abraham Lincoln. It's victory belongs to the man who doesn't get out of it, but he's the courage to get into the arena and gets down and gets up bloodied and blah, blah, blah. There's a really good quote, but I can't.
Yes, I know that one and I can never remember it off by heart, but it's brilliant. Yeah,
it
absolutely.
It's a great one, isn't it? And just as an aside, my other favourite quote is leap and the net will appear.
Yeah, absolutely. And on a similar vein, actually, if I turn around behind me, I've got a poster on my wall that says, there is freedom waiting for you on the breezes of the sky. And you ask, but what if I fall? And the answer is, oh, but my darling, what if you fly?
yeah.
And it's a similar thing. It's, you know, you really do just have to have that courage to go for it, because really, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah. Well, in your case, maybe.
Well, yeah. Fair enough. I can't argue with that. Yeah. There are certain croc-infested rivers that maybe if you leap, you might not. Yeah, certainly. When I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I won't be leaping off my boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. Calculated risks is what I take when I'm out on expedition.
So, Ness, my brain is going all over the place because there's so many things I want to pick up on, so much valuable stuff in there. But can I go back to the resilience? You talked about resilience, about keep getting up again and again. Mm-hmm. Is there a story you can that comes to mind of a time when, not necessarily in one of your adventures, but actually maybe an adventure as well, but perhaps preparing for an adventure, the funding, or, you know, trying to get your business off the ground, something where you almost gave up?
Mm. Oh, yeah, I've got plenty of those. And they do, don't get me wrong, these keep happening. You don't suddenly miraculously become this person that never fails and never has to, you know, go through that and call on that resilience. Like, that's ongoing. But you get better at managing it and expecting it. But yeah, certainly, I mean, with my career, it's, you know, it's the same as running any business. So I have to, a lot of people only see the expedition side of it and think, well, that's a wonderful career and off you go. And, you know, that looks like quite an easy life. But in reality, 90% of my time is spent at home doing the admin work behind my computer to make these things happen. And in order to do that, I have to run everything like a business and I have to wear multiple hats. So I do my marketing, I do my PR, I do my accounts, I, you know, do the logistics and the fundraising. Everything is done myself. I even build my website, I do my social media. So it's a huge, daunting task, especially, you know, for example, leading up to this Pacific expedition. But yeah, over the years, I've had some big expeditions that have required a lot of funding to get off the ground and a lot of planning. And I know, you know, about 3 years ago, I went through a really rough patch, actually, where I've almost gave up. And I was right at the beginning of my career. And because of what I do is quite an unusual thing, I had quite a job on my hands, although people were proud of me, of what I was doing and achieving, you know, my friends and family. They did find it quite difficult that I was going off around the world and doing these things that they perceived as incredibly dangerous and that they didn't know much about and that they really, quite honestly, feared, because they didn't know whether I would come back alive. And it's easier for me because I'd been through a few expeditions and I knew that I was safe and I knew that I, you know, as I said, I take calculated risks. Everything, the minutiae of the detail that we go drill down into in the planning and organization of these is massive, and the safety element is a huge part of that and mitigating any risk and issues. So I knew that that was safe, but it was quite a big job to convince those around me that this was a good idea for me to chase after this career and this passion of mine. And so I struggled a lot with a number of things around that time. One was support. Again, don't get me wrong, they were so proud, but really scared. It was a big unknown for them. If I wanted to become an accountant, that's the known to everybody. So that's all right. And everyone's like, yes, great. We know about that. Wonderful. Exploring, different story. And so that not having a huge support unit around me was difficult. And at that time, I hadn't really made a huge number of friends in, you know, the world of exploration. I just didn't know that many people yet. I hadn't been out networking and getting to know people. So I didn't have that to call on either. And then I was trying to raise funds for expeditions. And obviously, as everybody gets multiple times, people say, no, that's wonderful, we love the idea of it, but it's not for us, sorry. And there was lots of no's. And then you're trying to build a business and a brand, and you have to have, you know, call on all this creativity to do the marketing side of things and keep upbeat and be able to do your, you know, build pitches for that when you're trying to sell people into your ideas and your expeditions, and to try and keep that level of positivity there, to try and move forwards and make the funds that you need and get the right partnerships on board and keep positive. That was really hard, really hard. And actually, I stepped back from adventure for a little while and I slipped into depression. And I'd never experienced that before. I'd never been depressed in my life before. And so that trying to come back from that was really hard. And that's where I learned that you have to call upon the support of others around you. Without that, you know, I think it's really easy for us in this day and age to feel like we need to be these superhuman people that are just good at everything naturally in order to look and appear successful to others and to ourselves, that we have to win all the time. And we put a huge amount of pressure on ourselves that we have to do it solo. And that, to me, is just the worst way that you can go about things. And what I've really learned in business and life in general is just don't be that little island on your own. And I think, you know, I've seen in so many ways in business and through my expeditions, and also the tribes and the cultures that I've met in some of the most remote parts of the world, most recently in Namibia, the value that they put on collaboration and support of each other is huge. And that's the success of them. You know, they're incredibly happy people. And the best businesses and entrepreneurs that I know are people who understand the power of collaboration. And so, yeah, I guess that really was what started to turn things around for me again. But yeah, I've had to pull on that resilience a lot and, you know, put the ego away too. There's no room for ego. Just chuck it to the side, leave it on the table and ask for support around you and get, you know, I think who you keep around you is very important, and the kind of attitude to life that they have is very important. So try and, you know, build a network of people close to you who have a really great outlook on life, who will be a positive influence on you and moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you. So would you say that, I mean, how long did that period of depression last?
Oh, about 2 years. quite well. It was a very slow coming out of it. And it, you know, if you look at the expeditions that I did, I'm trying to go back through the date. So I did my Thames swim in 2013. Mm-hmm. And then I did a 400-mile run from London to Lantern straight off the back of that. And then it went quiet for a period of time. And then a couple of years later, I headed out to Bolivia, and things started getting moving again. And I struggled during that period of time to pick myself up. So it was extended, and oh, I learned a lot. Yeah, it was tough. It was definitely really tough.
What were the most valuable things that you learned apart from that, that what you've talked about with reaching out for support and not being an island?
From going through that tough time?
Yeah.
I think sometimes, you know, and this goes for everything again, during that time, I learned very strongly that, you know, things can seem very overwhelming. And there were days where I was lying in bed in my pajamas at 11 in the morning, and I was so depressed, I didn't even have the energy to lift my arm to get my cup of tea next to me. You know, I really just had nothing. There was absolutely nothing there. And I learned that sometimes when things feel so overwhelming, the most important thing you can do is reel things back in and go back down to sometimes the very smallest possible next step and just do that thing. And once you get there and you've done that thing, then find the next smallest possible next step and do that. And slowly but surely you build momentum. And I think that's really important, is to try and get momentum going. And it's the same with expeditions. You know, so many times I've been out there and, you know, like in Namibia recently last year, it was heading towards 50 degrees Celsius and I was dehydrated, exhausted, you know, lacked sleep deprived and, you know, lacked any kind of motivation to go forward. And I would literally look ahead and see a rock about 10 meters ahead of me and say, okay, well, I'm just going to cycle to the rock and put my foot on that rock. And then I'll take it from there. I'm not going to think about anything else. And I get to the rock and then you think, okay, well, next one, I'll do 20 meters for the next one. And then you get to the next rock and I'll just go to that corner and then I'll go to that ridge line. So really it's, yeah, bit by bit, small steps. As long as you are taking any step, no matter how small, it's moving forward, right? So that's really important.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, sister. I agree with you. Absolutely. Related to that, kind of just looking at that rock in front of you, that first, you know, not even the obstacle, but just taking those baby steps, do you practice mindfulness?
So I've only just recently started looking into this. I mean, some people have said to me, well, yeah, naturally through your expeditions and how you've described things, you seem to practice bits of mindfulness. But I think it's a really interesting thing that I would love to learn more about. Apparently I do a little bit, and I'd like to introduce that into what I do a lot more. I think, you know, many aspects of my expeditions and, you know, the building of my business and the balance and happiness that I have in my life will probably really grow and benefit from that. So I definitely want to look into it more.
Oh my goodness. Goodness knows what you're going to achieve with mindfulness.
I think I need to get onto this one pretty soon.
I've been practicing for about 4 years now. It's made a real difference for me. And I use Get Some Headspace, and they have different packs. And at present, I am going through a pack called Mindfulness for Sport and for Training. And so the introduction is all about how we have to get over ourselves when we have a goal, especially, you know, a goal that's an adventurous goal, or, you know, a physical sports goal, and how we have to push ourselves. And, you know, it's like getting out of bed and, you know, doing that. And that whole thing about putting it into perspective and mindfulness and being in the present and enjoying that presence. So it's very useful, but I suspect you probably do practice it without knowing what it was called.
Yeah, I guess, you know, like I can think one of the things that someone said to me recently that I do, which is mindfulness, is when I get up in the morning, I didn't think about that, literally those first 15, 20 minutes of when I wake up and what I do and the narrative that's in my head. And through adventure and expeditions and that kind of extreme endurance that I've been testing myself at and pushing myself to the limit, I now set my day and my mindset and my attitude and my feelings to the day literally when I first wake up, and I don't leave it to chance. So I wake up and I think, right, this is the day ahead, this is the kind of stuff I want to achieve, this is the attitude I'm going to go into it with, and I kind of give myself a little pep talk, and that sets me off on the right footing. And I find the days that I don't do that and I just leave it to chance are the days that I'm the least productive. So that's definitely believe in all that stuff.
That's a great top tip. Can I ask you, what did you set as your mindset and attitude for today?
So this morning was all about creativity. I've got a big talk coming up in a couple of days. I'm also doing a pitch for a lot of my fundraising, and I just need to be in a very, very positive mental space in order to get creative. I get that kind of creative person, that block, if I'm not feeling in the right atmosphere, in the right place, then I don't get the best out of myself. So I actually spend time with my dogs very first thing in the morning, because I lift my spirits up and, you know, kind of think through the rest of the day and what my plan is and getting into that creative mindset. And yeah, that was today.
Oh, wonderful. Do you train first thing in the morning? What's your training regime like?
At the moment, it's to be honest with you, it's all over the place just because of my schedule. It's all over the place. And I'm struggling a little bit with that, because I do like to have some kind of, you know, general skeleton idea of what my week's going to look like. But my training sometimes is early in the morning, sometimes it's midday, sometimes in the evening. I do find, though, that the times that I train first thing in the morning and get up, you know, 6 a.m. session, and by 8 o'clock I'm ready for the day and having my coffee, those are the best days, the most productive days for me. I do struggle a lot. If I leave my training to the end of the day, then I'm already tired mentally and exhausted. It's not really how I want to end my day. So I do prefer training early morning, and it's energizing. And obviously we all know that doing exercise releases those happy endorphins. It's definitely a morning one if I can get it in early.
Are you a CrossFitter?
I am now. So I've been following these on Instagram. I'm a sucker for this, I have to admit. And I've been watching them for 2 years. I've been going through my Instagram looking at all these motivational fit people and, you know, they do that competition, the fittest on earth. I mean, it's phenomenal what they can achieve. And so about 2 months ago, I signed up to my local CrossFit and I am doing it now, and it is hard. They make it look so easy. I guess it's the same thing with gymnastics and those kind of sports, is it looks effortless, really effortless. And then you try it and you just can't even lift your leg up. It's awful. So that's what, yeah, for my Pacific Ocean Road that I'm heading out on next year, there's three really important things for me, and that is flexibility, core strength, and muscle mass. So as I go, I'm going to be spending 6 to 9 months out at sea alone. And once I've depleted my fat stores, which I do need to actually up before I go, so I need to put on weight before I head out. Once the fat stores go, my body will start using my muscle mass as fuel. And so I'll start losing that very quickly. Also, the power for rowing is in your legs. So I really need to build that up. I've got these little skinny legs, so that's what I need to work on. And then obviously, yeah, your core strength to prevent injury, and flexibility. So I incorporate at my CrossFit, they do a lot of Ashtanga yoga and something called animal flow. And so I'm the least flexible person. It's horrendous and quite embarrassing. So that's a long journey ahead of me, and it's not a pretty one. But yeah, I'm giving it a go bit by bit. I'm starting to see the results come through now.
So tell us about your next challenge, your record attempt across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, well, where do I start? This is one that's been in my mind for about 7 years now. So before I even began to think about adventure and exploration as a career, I was following a lady called Roz Savage. And she at the time was in her, I think, her early 30s, heading towards her mid-30s. She'd been a management consultant for many, many years. And in a similar way to what I was doing, was just kind of ticking boxes and going through life and just doing life. And she just needed more. And she ended up heading out and rowing. She became the first female to row all around the world. So she did it in stages year by year. And she rowed the Pacific in three different stages. And then she did the Indian, she's on the Atlantic. And I just looked at the story and it just really, really spoke to me and sparked something in my imagination. And I just thought to that, you know, from that very first day, that was the seed that was planted. I was going to at some point row an ocean. I just thought it was the most unknown, crazy thing that I could ever imagine doing. So regardless of doing this for a career, I still would have done the row. And for 7 years, I thought about it. When I started the adventure career, somebody who I trusted close to me said to me, right in the early stages when I got really excited, okay, I was, you know, going to be an adventurer, I'll go do the Pacific row. They said to me, well, what's your reason for doing it? And at the time I had so many different reasons why I wanted to do it. I didn't explain it very well and I stumbled over it. Well, I really want to feel what it feels like to row halfway across the world on your own steam, you know, using your own body. And I just thought it was the most fantastic thing. And they said to me, well, that's not a good enough reason. You can't do that. That's just not good enough. And I listened to them, unfortunately, for a good few years. And I never embarked on it because they basically said, well, you know, that's not a good enough reason, so you're not allowed to. You'll look like a fool. And it's only, I guess, as my career post-depression, actually, and as I've got back into this career and built things up, and, you know, I'm really in a good place, that I thought, you know, the time is right now, and I'm so ready to do this, that I just thought, right, let's start planning it. And so, yeah, it's been a long time coming.
And when you started planning it, what was the first thing that you do? Is the first thing that you do is you try to secure sponsorship funding or something else?
The first thing you do is buy a giant map and put it up on the wall. So my office, the entire kind of, it's a slanted roof and the whole thing is a map of the world, like enormous map. And so, yeah, I bought that and then plotted out the route for that. And I stare at that all day. And then from that point, I set it up a bit like you'd set up a major project for, you know, your business. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a skeleton structure of a business plan for it. And I got those, you know, those giant rolls of paper, and I stuck them to my wall and started plotting out all the different elements from the marketing side, the fundraising side, the partnerships, the equipment, the team, everything involved. I put a timeline together of how long I thought it would take, and then all the contingency around that. And then from there, I started really kind of going into each one of those and, you know, exploding those out and writing a much more detailed plan for each one of those different sections. Then I got the marketing side of it together enough that, I mean, I didn't have a perfect plan, to be honest with you, but it was enough to get my marketing together, get a sponsorship proposal put together. Because of my digital marketing background, I could luckily do that all myself, so there was no cost behind that, and built a pitch and just started going out and working on my LinkedIn connections. I literally connected with thousands of people on LinkedIn that I thought would be fantastic for, you know, building relationship in the future, in terms of my expeditions and partnerships and sponsorship and things like that. And I just started contacting people and cold calling, and also getting in touch with my network that was existing and asking them if they knew anyone who might be interested in getting all the warm contacts, because that's so much easier than cold calling. And the response was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So, yeah, it's been good fun. And from there, you know, obviously once those funds start trickling through, then you can start working on getting the equipment and, you know, organizing the boat builds and things like that. So it's just literally as you would with any company, it's putting together a major project.
Wow. When you're telling me this, I'm thinking about how many parallels, because essentially you're starting a new business each time, aren't you? There's so many parallels.
Yeah.
Well, it is a business.
Absolutely. No, it's exactly the same structure, exactly the same things you have to think about and put together and organize in the same way that I would approach it for any other business. Yeah.
And I also think, Ness, that what you're sharing with people who'll be listening here is that there's going to be people listening who have no interest in doing adventures or no interest in starting a business or growing their business, but who have a career, but there's so many lessons that you can take here from your career. So, for example, you know, how do you use your LinkedIn contacts, for example, that somebody might be able to mimic that to their next career move?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, for me, the very first step on LinkedIn was taking a step back, asking people around me what they thought about my existence, and a lot of people that weren't close, just close friends, you know, so kind of business connections that were good enough, you know, close enough that I could ask them for this favor, and trying to get people that wouldn't be emotionally connected to me to tell me honestly with constructive criticism what they thought of my profile. And so, yeah, leaning on the support of others for that, then taking that and building my LinkedIn profile so that it was kind of that all 5-star, you know, bells and whistles, singing and dancing, and really learning how, you know, the most important thing, I'll be honest with you, with my LinkedIn and with all my branding, regardless of whether you're a business or you're just somebody looking to forge your career, you still have to think about your brand. Who are you and what can you offer? And so much of pitching yourself or pitching a project or pitching a company is the ability to storytell. If you can't connect with people and really get them to understand both the logic but also the passion and the vision behind it, then it becomes incredibly difficult to move forward and get them to buy in. And so if you can learn how to storytell, learn how to get your profiles in the various, you know, places like LinkedIn up to scratch, then that's hugely helpful. And so I got that up to scratch, and then I started connecting with people by literally using LinkedIn. It's incredible because the ability to drill down in the searches is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So you can find exactly the right people in exactly the right places to connect with. And I would click connect and then write a little personal note for every single one of them. Now, it sounds like a huge amount of hard work, and it did. It took me hours and hours and hours. But the payoff now, months and years later, is huge because those people felt that I was genuinely wanting to connect with them, which I was, and I had taken the time and effort to write something personal to them. And so, yeah, really and truly, like, you can't cookie cutter anything and just blast it out because, you know, people just delete it or, you know, not even bother reading it. So really that personal connection with people and customizing everything was critical. And I think now I have I think I've got the upgraded premium version of LinkedIn. And so if I'll save the in-mails that I have for key people. And then just having the courage, you know, quite often I'll be like, oh no, I can't connect with them. They'll probably think I'm weird. But no, just do it. Just connect with them, find something to connect with them about and make it personal. And it's been great. And yeah, it's been the one thing that's brought in so much of my sponsorship. So it's been fantastic.
When you connect with those people that you're initially reluctant to connect with because you think you're worried they might think you're weird, are you, even though it's personal, are you, I guess you're upfront to say, this is why I'm connecting with you and this is what I'm hoping to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. People appreciate honesty. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than someone trying to connect with you. And you can just, it's so obvious when someone's trying to give you a little, you know, like trying to sales pitch you, but make it sound like it's not a sales pitch, but it really, you know, like, just be honest. There's nothing that beats that. Just be honest. Because frankly, if you go through all this effort to try and, you know, pretend like there's some other reason why you're wanting to connect, down the line, you're going to, you know, ask them for that thing and they're just going to say no. It's, you know, rather get the no up front than waste your time and get a no down the line. So people are either open to it or they're not. And, you know, for the most part, most people have been pretty fantastic with connecting. And most of the time, if I'm upfront and honest with them, they'll turn around and say, well, no, this is not, it's a lot of things are right time, right place. So they might be interested in you, but just not at that point in time because the business is not looking for that at that point in time, but you're still going to be, you know, at the forefront of their mind because you connected with them when the time is right for them. So a lot of what I've learned around business and connecting with people is front of mind awareness. And so once I've connected with them, what I do is make sure that I put up the occasional updates and posts that are thoughtful and relevant so that they'll hopefully see those in their stream and just, you know, I'll keep cropping up. So that's really, it is just honesty. I'm not a fan of trying to, you know, pretend that you're there for any other reason than what you are.
I like that. It's really fascinating to hear you talking as an explorer and an adventurer about your LinkedIn process. It's not what I was...
Well, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
It's not what I was expecting.
Well, no, I mean, if you think about it, as an explorer, there are so many people that I'm going to want to connect with, not just for fundraising, but also there's people that could be great partnerships, so services partnerships with me, not financial fundraising. There's also people who are directors and producers and the creators out there. There's people that work within publishing industries. All of this stuff is relevant to me. There's coaches out there who are fantastic storytellers that actually me going and having a coffee with them somewhere down the line would probably be incredibly useful for me. And some of the best connections and the biggest doors that have been opened for me and the most amounts of money that have come my way are from the least expected people. The guys that I thought, well, I connect with them, but I'm really not sure what can come out of that. And you just don't know who they know.
Mm.
So, you know, don't discount people.
Yes, absolutely. I run a monthly business breakfast for women in business as part of an organization called Forward Ladies. And I always, when I'm speaking to people about networking and about the way we do things at Forward Ladies, it's very informal networking. And I say to people who might have been to more traditional networking events, don't come here expecting to kind of give your business card to someone and they're going to be on the phone next week ordering your thing or your service. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. That is so, you know, last century. It's unbelievable. It's, it's about connecting, being interested in people, and just never know where it's going to land. And it's always from the most, as you say, always from the most unexpected places. You can't control the outcome.
Yeah, well, so an example of this is a few years ago when I started out on my speaking career, I would go out and basically for free do talks to companies locally in the area that I was in. And to be honest, anywhere that I possibly could, for two reasons. One, because I needed the practice. And the more you do something, the better you get quicker. And I didn't want to do, you know, one talk a month and then have to drag out this process of getting better at it. I'd rather do one talk every two or three days and fast track that process. The other reason was because I knew by giving something away for free and going and inspiring people and not asking for anything in return, those people at those events, they ran their own companies, they worked for other companies. And an example of this is a lady who, I to be honest with you, I didn't even remember her because I never really met her at the event. But I did a free talk, and then 2 years later, I get a phone call because she's now working for a huge corporate and wants me to come in. And then there you go, there's $5,000 worth of one talk. Do you know? So it pays off. And I think it's being able to see every single relationship and event as the ability to invest in a possible open door down the line in the future. Mm. And I see it this way, that I've always said to people, you know, it's with so many things in life, the more cards you go through, the more aces you find. So don't hold back. Don't, you know, try and do as much as you can, you know, whenever you can. And if that's doing free stuff or it's just connecting with as many people as possible and just being very open with people and very genuine and authentic with people, it really does pay off, because, you know, like we said, it comes from the most unexpected places down the line. So it's really, truly worth it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's I have an analogy. It's throwing spaghetti at the walls. You just never know which bit's going to stick.
Brilliant. I love that. It reminds me of when I was a little kid of about four, I used to get the toilet roll and, you know, get clumps of it and damp it and throw it. Sorry, I was off on a tangent, but I used to throw it. My mum did her nuts. It was all over the house and stuck to every corner of the house. But yeah, no, absolutely. Sorry.
I hope it wasn't my toilet roll, Ness.
No. Definitely not. I wasn't that naughty as a kid.
You took that rebellious streak a bit far.
Yeah, no, I was rebellious, but not quite there.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I am going to have to ask my last question. Although, I would like to keep you talking for the next 3 hours.
Oh, thank you. I love Karen Chang.
Oh, God, it's been absolutely wonderful. And you know, there's so many other places we could explore. And by the way, remind me, when we finish the interview, I've got a great contact for you.
Oh, you see?
There we go.
Thank you.
I can probably think more than one, in fact. You say that your mission is helping others, ordinary people, can achieve extraordinary things. So for all the women and some men who might be listening to this this podcast, what would your message to them be about feeling ordinary and what they should do to achieve what they their heart dreams of but they daren't actually go for?
Okay. Oh, do you have a few hours that I can explain? there's so many things. But I'll try and get down to, I suppose, the most important things that I found for me have really worked. Really genuinely, doing a very physical, proactive thing like sitting down and really asking a question, if I knew I could not fail, what would I do with my life? Mm. If you remove all those insecurities, what would you do with your life if you knew that you were going to succeed at it? Write all those things down and really start making the changes to do that, because it is so worthwhile. I think there's nothing, I can think of nothing worse than getting 20 years down the line, genuinely, and knowing, because we know this, people have spoken about this for decades and centuries, the thing we regret the most are the things that we didn't have the courage to do in our life. We don't regret the things that we did and we failed and we made mistakes. That's, you know, a part of life. It's the things that we didn't have courage to do in the first place that we all regret. So do them, you know, sit down, write that list and start making those changes. It really does seem, you know, quite daunting at first, because, you know, a lot of us have commitments that we've already invested in and we're scared that those things are going to fall away. But you don't have to do this overnight and instantly. You can work towards it on the side. I think I was reading somewhere the other day, I can't remember the exact number, but out of a year, the amount of days that we have off, including weekends and holidays and things like that, stack up to about 120.
Wow.
So we can find a little bit of time within that each year to, on the side, grow whatever it is and then make that transition period. And I think in terms of, you know, it is really, I'm a very ordinary person. Really, I truly am. I'm not sporty. I'm not born for this. I'm very uncoordinated. I'm very clumsy. I walk into door frames all the time. I have no spatial awareness. I should not be doing what I do. Very ordinary person. But it's, you know, it's that whole idea that just got to keep reminding yourself that every single one of us who have mastered something was a beginner at some point. We've all been there. We're not, none of us are different to each other from that perspective. So we're all ordinary people. We've just grown experience. So if you can just have the courage and the resilience to keep plodding through and taking the next smallest possible next step, you'll absolutely succeed. And I think that's it. You know, just we're not supposed to be extraordinary superhuman. We are all ordinary. Just the things that we end up achieving are the extraordinary things.
Thank you.
Yeah. And also a plea, really, one of the things I'm most passionate about in life is that if you succeed and if you start finding yourself on the way up, please pull people up with you. That's really important, you know, and that whole ripple effect of positivity that just if you really think about it, if you just help one person up, that person is going to have the similar kind of effect on those around them because they were helped. And it goes on indefinitely. That's an amazing thing to do. So, yeah, just pull people up around you. It's just the best thing.
Yes, absolutely. Works so much more energetically. And that's what changing the world is, one person at a time.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
So that,
I know it sounds corny and cheesy, but it really, it's my everything.
Yeah, it really is. That really is the ordinary people achieving extraordinary things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ness, thank you very much. I will put a link in the show notes to your website and your Twitter feed and probably also your LinkedIn feed.
I better make sure it's in order then. Yeah, absolutely. Please do. And anyone can feel free to connect with me.
And I'm definitely going to go and put a microscope to your LinkedIn profile. You might be getting an email from me saying, Ness, please give me some constructive criticism on my LinkedIn
story. More than happy to help. Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Ness. It's been an absolute joy.
Oh, likewise. Thank you so much for having me. I've had a blast, an absolute blast. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.